The following podcast was created to help 100 Women in Finance members learn more about us, our programs and priorities, and especially our people. In this series, we introduce you to our Global Association board members, the people who steer the organization through sound governance and financial management and ensure that we advance our mission. We hope that you enjoy the podcast, and we welcome your feedback at media@100women.org.
Hello, everyone. I'm Amanda Pollinger, CEO of 100 Women in Finance. On today's installment of our Meet the Board Member podcast, I have the pleasure of speaking with Ulrika Borkhardi, one of our newest board members. Some background about Ulrika. She oversees a fundamental global equity portfolio inside Tudor's Investment Corporation's flagship client strategy and serves on Tudor's strategy and quantitative investment committees. Her professional interests center on innovation and digital transformation. Investing in companies that benefit from disruption, she makes substantial use of new data sources to understand market trends and technology adoption. Ulrika has been with Tudor for more than 20 years and has worked in both its London and New York offices. Outside of work, Ulrika is an ally for the next generation. An advocate for STEM education in grades K through 12, she serves on the advisory board and as a coach for New York's first Robotics League, noting that her team won the 2019 Global Innovation Award. Well done, Ulrika. She has additionally joined the advisory board of Portfolios with Purpose, one of 100 Women in Finance's Investing in the Next Generation program partners that fosters investment literacy among pre-career diverse young people in the United States, mostly through gaming technology. Abundantly educated, Ulrika holds a PhD in finance from the London School of Economics and Political Science, a master's degree in finance from the University of St. Gallen in Switzerland, and a master's degree from the Community of European Management Schools. So welcome to the podcast, Ulrika. And before we begin, how have you been holding up during this very unusual time?
Thank you so much, Amanda. It's a pleasure to be here. To your question, that's a fully loaded question. And one that I've probably ignored. We are fortunate in the financial industry that we can work from home. To be frank, I was secretly excited to have more family time. But it's been paradoxical. I've never spent so much time with my husband and four daughters at home, but at the same time, seen so little of them. I don't know about you, but it just seems like one call, one email blends into the next, and one day into the other. But on a positive note, my daughters have become more self-sufficient, and they're even helping more with household chores. You know, and my husband recently was kind enough to share that he now realizes why it sometimes takes me some time to respond to texts. It's often literally back to back. But other than with my family, I've been so impressed with the ways in which so many have stepped in to help. Starting with Tudor, our founder and CIO, Paul Tudor Jones. He was so early in recognizing the extent of this crisis. And he organized one of the largest fundraisers to help with COVID relief. And I've also been impressed with our portfolio companies. You know, leadership is one of the criteria that is very important to us when we evaluate our investments. And it's been rewarding to see so many of our CEOs step up and playing a critical role in this crisis. They offered free products, they supported healthcare workers, and also their own employees. And my hope is that we will see very similar responses to this current crisis of societal inequalities.
Yeah, it's certainly been an interesting period of time, and I appreciate some of your reflections on your experiences. So let's get into the podcast and let's begin with your background. You were raised and educated in Europe before making your home in New York. I'd love to know more about your upbringing. You know, what can you tell us about your family and the time and place in which you were raised that might offer some hints about the professional life that you have today?
You may not believe this. I actually got into investing because of a board game. I grew up in Germany, and every year there would be a board game that critics would vote as the game of the year. And if there's one thing my family loves, it is board games. And every year we would excitedly wait for the announcement of the new winning game. And in 1985, it was a game called Caltrate. And I got hooked on this game. I must have put 10,000 hours into it. I guess when you put that much time into random things, it's a passion. To this day, I admire the patience of my parents and brother playing this game ad absurdum. You know, I wish it would have been poker or chess, something that other people would at least find interesting. But what's so fascinating to me about this game is that you have to weigh a current investment opportunity against a future one. And you have to make sure that you have enough cash on hand for the very best opportunities. And it teaches you that there are times to bet large and others where you have to be patient. And for me, that's probably one of the most important skills in investing. And Amanda, you mentioned abundantly educated before. There's certainly an academic bent in my family. My brother and I always joke that even if we would have chosen to work in a very practical profession, like a bakery, we probably would have felt compelled to do a PhD in, you know, something like yeast fermentation. But lastly, I'm so fortunate to have remarkable role models in my family. My mother, she used to work full-time, and at the same time, she's dedicated a lot of her time to help others. She used to tell us growing up that it's not what you say, it's what you do. And of course, you do what you say. And doing she does to this very day. And just one of the many things, she has taken on the role of becoming a second mother to a severely handicapped boy, now a man, for more than 30 years. And then my grandmother. She may not have been a women's rights activist, but she certainly broke the conventional paradigms of her time. She was one of the very first women with a PhD in finance. And she taught at university in evenings to support her family because she sadly lost her husband when her three children were very young. And if you think about that context in history, almost 100 years ago, it is quite extraordinary. So both are great sources of inspiration for me. And you know, I hope that I can foster the same confidence in my four daughters, that they pursue their interests and beliefs independent of what may be prevailing norms.
Interesting. And it's interesting, you know, mentioning some of the challenges and kind of juggling different parts of their lives. And you know, I know that you have daughters. And so, you know, in addition to your professional life, you're obviously juggling many other things at home. And clearly you kind of learned some of those balancing tools from your family. So thanks for sharing some of your personal background with us. You describe your work at Tudor as being centered on digital transformation. What sparked this interest, and why did you choose to pursue this fascination as an investor rather than a technologist?
Well, that's easy, because I always won the trading board game. It's actually my brother who ended up as a technologist. And it was clear very early on, he is extremely computer literate. And probably not surprisingly, he is now a software entrepreneur. And I think it's my father who spurred our technology fascination. He loves to be a first adopter. He was the one who bought our first PC, the Commodore 64, right when it came out in the early 80s. And this got me to think about technology and how it will change our lives. For me, it's fascinating to think about how the future looks when computers will take on more and more. And this is also why I chose to write my master thesis on the merging of the media, computer, and telecommunication industry. And that was right around the time the internet started. And since then, the digital share of our GDP has risen to about 8%. And there's still a long road ahead to transform all industries. And this is such an exciting opportunity to be invested in over the next decades. And I think that is very important. It is important that you are interested in what you're investing in. So investing purely for monetary gain just won't make you happy. Prospect theory says that we take losses twice as badly as we appreciate gains. And that's a pretty tough proposition in an investing role. But if you take a broader view and if you think about the founders, the management teams, these companies building a better future, then it is very fulfilling to see your investment succeed. But I think it's also very important to enjoy working with the people around you. And I'm lucky not only to have a great team, but also a great leadership team at Tudor. And I'd like to make a call out, if I may, to my colleague Louise Zarelli. She's a member of our management committee. And as you know, Amanda has been recognized by 100 Women in Finance for her leadership role in our industry.
So Ulrika, I completely agree. Louise has been a fantastic supporter of 100 Women, and I echo your comments about the team that's around you. It's been fantastic to work with Tudor over the years. So I'm curious whether you can program. You know, are you a practical technologist as well?
Yes, though I have not studied computer science like my brother did. I sort of picked it up as I needed it. I was first doing my PhD. There I had to ingest and transform large amounts of data that I would then use for statistical modeling. And then later on, when I started at Tudor in 1999, I actually first joined as part of Tudor's quantitative team. And I even learned Tudor's proprietary programming language. It was actually funny. It was a command line interface called the Tick Shell. And Tick, of course, stands for Tudor Investment Corporation Shell. I guess there are not many investment funds that have their own programming language. But those first 10 years of my career have been very educational. And in some sense, you know, I've been the practitioner of my own later investment thesis. But I think one thing that's important is that even if you're not out to win a hackathon, it is helpful that you have an understanding of how to code, even if it is very high level. It just helps you understand what is possible.
I figured you were going to say yes to that. So it's really interesting that you talked about, you know, the human side of this. You know, one of the things that's been interesting during COVID is we've had a number of female chief economists speak to 100 Women. And, you know, maybe it's me, but it's really interesting hearing a woman speak about the economy as opposed to a man, because I do think, and I'd love to know your opinion on this, I do think that women bring in a human element of looking at how people behave, where the economy is going, in a way that perhaps men don't. Perhaps men focus a little bit more on the numbers, on the kind of transactional side of the economy. What do you think about that?
That's a great observation, Amanda. Diversity of opinion is important. And as women, we bring in different perspectives. We have a different set of experiences. But I'd say more generally, diversity of background, whether it's ethnic, gender, educational, or otherwise, is a big factor to create more cognitive diversity. And this leads to better decisions as we look at a problem together from different angles. And we can come up with better and more creative solutions. And it's something that I see in my team every day. We have a lot of different skill sets among team members. And we need this diversity of skills and thought to be successful. We follow what some may call a quantamental approach to investing. So we need not only to leverage data, but also deep fundamental insights. Having said that, I think it's also important that there are no role stereotypes. You know, women are often associated with soft sciences and men with hard sciences. A woman can easily be as successful a quant or a technology investor as a man. And the same holds true for ethnicity. Just because we do not see a lot of something does not mean they should not be there. And there's a famous quote, "You can't be what you can't see." And role models, like you've pointed out, Amanda, many times, are so critically important to change perception, our own, but also the ones of others. And let me use statistics to illustrate this a bit. The status quo that we perceive affects our null hypothesis. This means the thesis that we'd like to test with data. So let's say we see a lot of white males as pilots. We are more likely to think that being white and male makes you a successful pilot. So it becomes our null hypothesis. And to reject this thesis, we need a lot of data to the contrary. Let's now take the case of a black female. The null hypothesis is likely that she does not have the skills to be a successful pilot. To reject this thesis, she will have to provide a lot of data. Lots and lots of miles flown without incidents to become a pilot. So it's possible for her to become a pilot, but it's difficult. And I think it is on all of us to change this. We need the same null hypothesis for everyone. Let me close by saying that I do believe it serves women well to be data literate in this coming era of digital and data. Having these skills will allow women to have a seat at the table and to help solve the most pressing problems. And I think this is also the way we, with 100 Women in Finance, can equip our members to have more seats at the table by 2040.
Interesting. So let's talk a bit about data science, which is the cross-discipline blend of various tools, algorithms, and machine learning principles that discover hidden patterns from raw data. It is amongst the highest in-demand skill sets in today's digital world in virtually all industries, but as you mentioned, especially in investing. The World Economic Forum estimates that only 15 to 20% of data scientists are women. And the Boston Consulting Group surmises that data science doesn't resonate with female students because they see it as too theoretical with low impact. So can you continue to help us unpack this and maybe share some ideas for how we in the finance industry can help show female students how a professional life working with data can have real world impact and benefit?
Yes, sure. It's actually one of my favorite topics. And let me start off with where I see the opportunities in the future. So data is the other side of digital. Every digital action leaves a data footprint. And as our world is more and more sensorized, we collect more and more data. A plane flying from Europe to the US has thousands of sensors. It creates terabytes of data. And as our world turns more and more digital, our data volume will explode. We are in the very first inning. And so with this in mind, I would encourage all of our members to invest into both their digital and their data skills. Skills in these areas will open up opportunities, and they can be useful in any functional role, from back office, and you can think about process automation, portfolio management, you can look at new sources of digital data, to marketing, thinking about digital communication channels. But more broadly, I would think about data science as a means to an end. I would think about it as a tool that helps you to better solve problems. If we think about the biggest problems we face, whether it's inequality, climate crisis, or pandemics, we need data to help us understand to what extent policies or really any other remedies affect outcomes. So even if you find certain aspects of data science dry, if you think about how you can use it to solve these important problems, it becomes so compelling. If you look at the COVID crisis, for example, so many elements of this crisis can be addressed with data. We can study the effects of social distancing, the effect of temperature on transmission. We can use data to optimize the path to reopening. And we also need data to test medications and vaccines. And maybe lastly, we can use data to help solve the climate crisis. By how much can we reduce our carbon footprint when we travel less? Data will help us answer this question. There was actually just an article in Nature that showed that our global CO2 emissions decreased by 17% year over year during this crisis. And about half of that came from less surface transport. So this data can be the basis for new policy prescriptions.
So you've mentioned some areas around COVID. So can you take us through an example? And I know you may not want to be very specific, but can you take us through your use of data science as you think about investing? How does it come into play? Give us some specifics around the type of data that you may be looking at on a particular investment. And I'm not asking you to give us a particular a name of it or anything, but just give us some ideas about how you work with that data.
Amanda, you might like a more concrete answer here than what I can offer. I think what's important just in terms of our process is that we start off with a thesis and not with the data. And then only in the second step, we are using data to check whether our thesis holds. Are we right about where the company is headed? Are we right about how well the management team is executing? Are we right about the competitive dynamics of an industry? Data objectifies reality, and so we are less likely to be lost in a narrative. And we use a variety of different data sources. We buy some data, and we also collect our own data. And we try to put these different data sources together in a mosaic, and we try to derive insights from that resulting picture. I mean, let's take the example of credit card data. It's a good proxy for a company's revenue, but it can also be misleading. For example, in cases where the credit card data is from very specific regions. And say, for example, you have credit card data that is largely from the Midwest. So what you're seeing there may not be relevant for companies with many more stores in other areas of the US. So you need the store footprint to help assess what you're seeing. And also revenue is price times volume. So are you seeing higher revenue because of lower prices and higher volume? Likely a result of promotions? That could be very negative for a company's margins. So tracking promotional trends is also important to round out the picture.
It's really fascinating me. How do you keep yourself from being too buried in the data when you're looking at a particular solution? Because I can imagine that there's so much data out there. How do you make sure that you are looking at the details, but actually also focused on the bigger picture?
Yes, Amanda, that's actually a really important question. It's easy to get lost in the noise, especially if you look at very short-term trends in the data. And to balance that risk, we try to spend a lot of time with management teams, often over many years, and we try to understand the vision of the company and also the strength of the leadership team. So in those cases, if you see short-term negative data, it really doesn't diminish our confidence in the long run, especially if we've seen those management teams have overcome challenges before. So what I would say is, as long as we are seeing that the company is headed in the right direction, we're happy to stick out a somewhat bumpy ride.
Great, that's really interesting. So my final question is that, you know, during this COVID period, many have observed that we're likely to see a quantum change in technological adoption. So at 100 Women, as you mentioned, we've not only moved our education content online, but we've also dramatically increased the amount of programming we can now deliver to our global members. And we're seeing an enormous benefit in terms of that globalized reach and really added value to our global members in being able to tap into the content that we're providing. And also the connectivity of our members, seeing each other on those Zoom calls, et cetera. So as a data transformation expert and as a 100 Women in Finance board member, what insights can you offer, and what would you advise 100 Women to do further in terms of developing its digital delivery of content and connectivity to serve our members?
Well, first off, I'd like to commend you and 100 Women in Finance for all the digital efforts. Even before the crisis, Sarah Dyer, our Chief Marketing Officer at 100 Women in Finance, has done a terrific job with social media. We've now reached 10,000 LinkedIn followers, and that's up from just 4,000 a year ago. I mean, triple digit growth rates. Those are the envy of even many tech companies. Amanda, you made two great points about the benefits of digital. And as you said, first off, digital is more scalable. There are no physical constraints of space, there are no country boundaries. You are immediately global. And secondly, as you mentioned, you're more agile. You can curate content more quickly and deliver it more quickly. But I think there's one third advantage of digital that we could use further, and that is that it allows us to personalize services and to tailor them to specific needs. This in turn requires data. And one idea would be to use this moment for an online survey. We could ask our members, what are your key interests? Professionally, topically, skill-wise. And based on this feedback, we could customize content offerings and networking opportunities. You know, there may be women who are interested in moving into a portfolio management role, and they're looking for advice. And we can match them with members who've done so. Others may want to take on more responsibility, and they're looking for specific professional development. And then yet others might want to learn about industry topics, like ESG. And I believe this feedback could allow us to plan our content pipeline better and also be more predictive of the needs of our members.
That's all great advice. Thank you so much for kind of thinking through that and sharing that. We will take some action on that. That sounds fantastic. So why don't we stop there for now? Thanks so much, Erica, and I look forward to talking with you more about all of this at our next board meeting.
Thank you so much, Amanda, for letting me share some of the enthusiasm that I have for our industry. And as a board member, I'm looking forward to our journey to the goal of 30% female representation in our industry by 2040. And who knows, maybe and hopefully we'll get there much faster than we think.
Thanks for spending part of your day with us. Remember to follow 100 Women in Finance on our LinkedIn page. You can also enjoy our past programs and connect with other members in the private section of our website, Community.